It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, make some frozen desserts for this week's edition of Food Friday. First, language can be used to connect people, but sometimes language rules can cause confusion and arguments, even among friends, family, and spouses. But help is on the way. Our next guest hit the road and traveled around the country, including here to Wisconsin, to set up a grammar table and answer questions from passerbys, or I guess passersby. She joins us now to share that experience and to tackle some of the funky twists and turns of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a nagging grammar question? Maybe a dispute you have with a friend or loved one? Is there something that you always stumble over when it comes to spelling something or how to write something or how to punctuate it? You name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ellen Jovan is the co-founder of a communication skills training consultancy called Syntaxis. She's the author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for letting me take my grammar party inside on this hot day. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. How did you get started as a roving grammarian setting up your grammar advice table?
I wasn't that roving at first. At first, I like grammar, in case that isn't clear yet. And one day I said, hey, I need a grammar table. So I ordered a table, made a sign, and I walked outside my building. There's a little park right there. So I didn't even have to go a full block. And I put it down and I started answering questions. So I roved one block initially, but then I started moving further around the city and eventually around the country.
And people, you set up shop here with your table, and people, it seems like, were really interested. They came up and had conversations and questions and arguments they had on hand. People love to talk about this with you.
They really do. To me, it's not surprising at all. Sometimes people say, who cares about grammar? No one cares about grammar anymore. And I'm thinking, you need to sit at the table with me for an hour, because people definitely care about it. They love talking about it. They love fake fighting about it. It can be really hilarious. It's this wonderful bonding instrument for conversation.
Let's get a taste of it. You shared an example with us from a grammar table interaction, this one in Milwaukee. So we can get a flavor of what's going on here. Here's a listen.
It's the grammar table. Do you have any grammar questions?
Yes. The use of commas. Both. Commas like to describe stuff, like more than one thing. Like,
if you have a list.
Dark brown hair, blue eyes, red lips, stuff like that.
That was very visually, I can't think of a word right now. You've left the grammar table speechless. So are you asking about the comma before the and, if it's a list of things?
No, how do we use more commas? We choose not to use commas at all, just a stream of consciousness.
Is this the collective familial we, or does we mean your kids?
My kids.
Sounds like this was a lot of fun. And I think a key, Ellen, is that you're not judgy about this at all, as far as I can tell. You wouldn't correct me and say, don't you mean judgmental, Rob?
I definitely wouldn't. I don't feel judgmental at all. I just think to me, this is really fun, and I'll just answer whatever question people have. I don't tackle them when they walk by. If I hear them use the wrong past participle, that's not how this works.
We're talking to Ellen Jovan, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. She brought her grammar table to almost every state in the country, including Wisconsin, to answer questions for people. And you can join in with your questions, your grammatical conflicts and confusions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Al is with us in Green Bay. Al, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So my question involves the word unique. I was brought up to believe that unique means one of a kind. Therefore, you would never put a modifier with it. You wouldn't say somewhat unique or kind of unique, because unique means one of a kind. It doesn't mean kind of one of a kind. But in later years, I've had other people try to tell me that unique simply means unusual. What's the ruling?
Al, thanks for the call. Ellen, how unique does something have to be before we can call it unique?
There's so many things that I could say about this, Al. I personally do not modify my unique. I use it as an absolute. So something is unique or not. I think the word is kind of spoiled because, you know, people who promote things like to make things very unique, extremely unique. And after a while, it just stops having the zing that it, you know, for me, it doesn't have much zing anymore. But it is used also by people to mean unusual. And it definitely takes on that meaning for me when they put an adverb in front of it. I just don't happen to do it myself. So Al, I have your back. I follow your ways, and, you know, the world changes around us, right?
Thanks for that call. And, you know, I always think of the United States Constitution. What are we going to create? A more perfect union, right? And some people, I think, to this day say, well, perfect, you're either perfect or you're not. And how do you get more perfect? But so this kind of question has been around a long time.
I mean, I think I kind of sympathize with the there can be a more perfect or more unique thing. Yeah, because if you have a tiny blue marble and then you have a somewhat like a twice as big blue marble next to it, you can say that, okay, in a collection of small marbles, that bigger blue one is unique. But what if you then have a green one that's 100 times as big? The gap between them is bigger. And I think that is captured by the language, even though people don't like it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Lexi is with us in Elkhorn. Lexi, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And I really love the title of the guest book. I just want to say that first. That's great. My question is about pleaded versus pled. Like, why do I hear on the radio he pleaded guilty? I think that's what I hear. And I want, like, my ear wants me to hear pled, like he pled guilty, but I don't hear people say that anymore. So I'm wondering what the difference is. And yeah, my ear just wants to hear that. It's a weird thing. Like, it hurts my ears when I hear pleaded guilty. And I also wanted to know how the guest became a grammar expert. That would be really interesting to me. And thank you.
Lexi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think pled is right, but it's a really weird sound word, like pled. I don't know. Question, Ellen.
Yeah, so this is an example of the kind of thing that I bring out usage books for. You know, so when I set up the table, I always have this big pile of books, and I rely on Brian Garner's book, Garner's Modern English Usage, for things like this, because he's a legal lexicographer. So may I just quote him briefly here for Lexi? Pleaded has always been the predominant past tense and past participial form. From the early 1600s, pleaded has appeared much more frequently in print sources than its rivals. Commentators on usage have long preferred it, pouring drops of vitriol onto has pled and has, oh, pled spelled E-A-D in that case. So my ear is used to pled, but, you know, this is one of the words actually that I have a little bit of an experiential gap between me and the usage experts on. And there's a whole bunch more on that I won't read to you, but it's more complicated often than people
Interesting.
Think.
Interesting.
And then there was a second part. Oh, how
did you
time?
Become a grammar expert? Yeah, okay. Just give a quick origin story, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I have taught writing and grammar my entire life. I majored in language and literature types of things. So I have a degree in German and an MA in comparative literature. I have studied 25 languages, well, more than that on my own. And I'm sitting in front of a giant library of grammar books right now. So it's a lifelong obsession.
All right. Let's go back to our callers now. Thanks for that. Becky is with us in Rio. Becky, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's really interesting. So the word that hurts my ears is the plural of attorney general. I think it used to be attorney generals. Now I always hear attorneys general, and that just sounds awkward to me. Is that correct, or why has it changed?
Ooh, is it correct, and has it changed, Ellen?
I'm not aware of that having changed. I think I can't say for sure what the frequency is of the plural formations unless I go check a database for you. But I've always, my whole life, which has been a little bit, you know, it's longer than average for the planet now. I've always done attorneys general, and I suspect that you just hear both because people are doing both. That's how it often is with language, but I would do attorneys general.
Yeah, because in this case, you think general, oh, that's like a military rank, so you're like the attorney general. But actually, general is a modifier of attorney. Like, you do lots of different stuff. So it's attorneys
exactly.
general. Did I
exactly.
get that right? Excellent.
Yeah, and you say, and I also say mothers-in-law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that would, I would too, for sure. Thanks. That's a great question at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Bill in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Hello. I have a sentence for you. The Austrian crystal chandelier crashed to the floor below. Now, I was told that the names of countries are always adjectives, but in this one, it's an adverb. I've gotten in fights about this. What do you think?
Fights? Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, I get it. The distinction here is the chandelier Austrian, or is it a type of crystal called Austrian crystal?
Uh-huh. Bill, may I ask you, how did this even come up? Do you always parse sentences that you encounter?
I gave this to my students as a question on an exam. It was always fun to debate about it, but a guy in a bar really got mad. He said that the names of countries are always adjectives. I said that this one is describing an adjective, which makes it an adverb.
I don't know.
Austrian.
I gotcha. Bill, I don't know how much time you've spent in Ellen, but we spent all our time getting into fist fights in bars over grammar and language. Basically.
Wow,
do you have a ruling for Bill on this one?
Well, I suspect, you know, it's funny because I grew up with, you know, sort of traditional grammar. I suspect linguists would probably not I would have to check with my linguist friends. I think they would probably not categorize it as adverbial strictly, but I see the point. I'm going to have to think about that.
All right, Bill. Thanks a lot. Keep it calm out there, man. We're talking with grammar and language expert Ellen Jovan about her experiences operating a public grammar advice table around the country. She shares the story in her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that's always nagged at you about grammar, spelling, punctuation, pronunciation? Do you have a pet peeve or you need something resolved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Ellen Jovan about her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Let's go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. We just heard about Austrian crystal. Now we'll go to Crystal Lake, Illinois with Carol. Carol, hi.
Hi, Rob. I can tell Ellen just loves her job just by that laugh. You can just tell. My query is about literally, and my beloved daughter uses it constantly, and I think, what does she mean? And then I'm seeing it written. A lot of people are using that now. What are they talking about?
Literally is literally everywhere, Ellen.
Don't start trouble here. Yeah, I mean, so when people say literally X happened and it didn't actually happen, it's a kind of hyperbolic statement. So I get it. Like I might say, oh my gosh, my head exploded when I heard that. And my head didn't actually explode. So I think that's kind of the idea behind the literally as non-literally supporting. That's that argument. I personally don't do that particular one. I exaggerate in many other ways.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Ellen, it seems like a lot of people have that pet peeve, that one or two or maybe 50 language things that bug them a lot.
It's true. And I actually think it serves various social functions that we probably can't quite grasp when we're busy arguing about them. I mean, so first of all, you often have peevers, like people who have peeves that they want to peeve about. And then you have peevers about peevers, who are the peevers who complain about the peevers. Well, no, they're not peevers. But they peeve about the peevers, which is a form of peeving. And it's kind of like this cycle. And it's sort of what I like about it is that even when people get annoyed, it doesn't usually come to fist fights. And I think there's a certain catharsis and a bonding thing in it, as long as it's not too mean. I don't like the mean-spirited peeving. Mm.
And we can say peever and peeving and to peeve. That's
I made up two words already this afternoon. So
yeah, I do it all the time too.
Ask if you want strict rules about that.
Thanks again for the call. Mike is with us next in Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have, I guess, a pet peeve, too, when people say things like between you and I, and I know it should be between you and me. And I actually had a boss at work. I almost got into an argument with her, but I knew better, you know, than to try to argue with my boss about it. But I said between you and me, and, yeah, she corrected me. It's between you and I, Mike.
Uh-oh. So. Right. Mike, thanks a lot for that. It gets tricky, though, Ellen, because depending on where it is in a sense, like, you and I are having a conversation, but this land was made for you and me, and then we, I don't know, it's easy to start second-guessing you and
Rob,
me.
Rob, that was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
May I respond?
Yeah, yeah.
Comment? Do I have time?
Definitely. Oh, we got lots of time.
Okay. So I actually was in an interview. I teach grammar courses to adults. So I was in an interview with a company where I was going to teach grammar courses for their employees. This was almost 20 years ago. And I said, you can feel free to call Brant or me. That's my partner or me. And then the person interviewing me asked about it because she thought it was wrong. And I explained it. And then I did not get that job. And the point of this is that there is grammar and then there's the politics of grammar.
Oh, well, I hope you got a better job after that with somebody more grammatically understanding. Thanks again for calling Ellen and me. We'll go next to Becky in Whitefish Bay. Becky, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I love this program. I love this topic right now. I have taught English language learners for almost 20 years. And the thing that gets to me is when people say conversate instead of converse. I've always thought it was converse. And I think that people say conversate maybe as default because of conversation.
Huh.
But that really irks me.
Becky, thanks. Ellen, I don't think I've encountered conversate all that often. Have you?
Oh, many, many times. It's really common. But, you know, I have talked to a lot of people
True.
About these things. Yeah, there are often coexisting forms of verbs, and some of them are more common or of words generally, not just of verbs, and that some are more common in certain dialects than in others. So I hear that among some demographics and less among others. And I don't say it, but I've gotten used to it. And I think it's always when there's a clash in a word that we use a lot or hear a lot, there's always a little clash in our brain as we process it. So I just wish for peace for you.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call. I'm conversating with Ellen Jovan. Her new book is called Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Good afternoon. I have a question about the word memoir and when somebody has written a collection of their life stories, is it their memoirs or have they written a memoir?
Oh, they both sound vaguely right to me, Ellen. What's the deal?
You're the first person who's ever asked me about that.
Huh.
I wrote my memoir. I mean, I think my default is singular, but I would actually have to investigate the history of that one to be certain. I try to be very responsible in the information dispensed from the grammar table. So, by the way, Rob, I'm going to also be posting on my Twitter account about the Austrian crystal question, because I think traditional grammarians will say adverb and the not and linguists will say something else. So I will also bring this one up there because this is fun for my grammar table language polls.
Excellent. All right. I will look for that later. Time for another call or two. Drew is with us in Grafton. Drew, hi. Are you there, Drew? Not hearing Drew. Let's try Victoria in Menominee. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Victoria?
My biggest pet peeve is when people say axe instead of ask. I would just like to slap them.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Now, there are a lot of words where kind of vowel or consonants will flip-flop, like nuclear, axe instead of ask. What do you think about that one, Ellen?
Yeah, there's actually a long history for that kind of thing where you see that flipping. That's not an area of expertise for me. That's more a linguist's domain. I believe John McWhorter, the linguist, has written about that, but it actually goes back a lot longer than people think, and has affected language in more ways, I suspect, than we realize. It's also part of African-American vernacular. So you might hear it more there. So it's also, you know, within certain groups, you hear certain things more than others. I grew up near the Valley in the 80s in Los Angeles. So there are things that I am doing right now that are probably annoying people, and they may write to me about it afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Victoria. Todd is with us now, calling from north of Toma. Todd, hello.
Hi there. I was calling about the terms data and datum. And data, to me, is a plural term, so the data are compelling. But I hear it actually on NPR a fair amount, where people use data as a singular.
Todd, great question. You cover this in the book, Ellen. I try to write around it, so I never say data is or data are. I just changed the damn sentence. What do you think?
I love this topic. I love all the grammar topics that intersect a little bit with mathy kinds of things. I love that extra. Somehow I haven't noticed that catching on as much with some other people, but I love it. Data it came into English as a plural, and datum came in as the singular. But here's reality for me. I cannot remember ever in my life hearing someone say datum, except maybe in some kind of scientific analysis. Data is used as a plural countable noun, but it is also used as a synonym for information generally. So the further you are away from a quantitative analysis with data points, the more likely you are to hear it as a singular. And I consider both acceptable.
Thanks for everybody's calls. And Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
That's Ellen Jovan, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Coming up after the news, when the weather gets hot, don't bake. Make some frozen desserts. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll keep it cool with ice cream and other sweet treats. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, school districts are facing teacher shortages around the country, including here in Wisconsin. We'll check out the problem and some possible solutions. Now it's cold, it's sweet, it's ice cream and sorbet, semifreddo, English pudding, custard. The list goes on for this week's edition of Food Friday. We're making some delicious frozen desserts for the heat of August. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite frozen dessert, something you can't get enough of? Do you make your own ice cream or other frozen treat at home? Love to hear about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about ice cream making, our guest might just have an answer. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bruce Weinstein is a chef and co-author of over 35 cookbooks, along with Mark Scarborough, including several books on frozen desserts. Their latest book is Instant Pot Bible, Copycat Recipes. They have a podcast called Cooking with Bruce and Mark. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, my pleasure.
You've written a bunch of cookbooks, three of them, I think, on frozen treats. Clearly, you have at least some love for this genre of cooking.
Yeah, my first cookbook ever was The Ultimate Ice Cream Book. So it was published in 1999, pre-internet, pre-digital. The book is still selling strong, still doing well. My best-selling book to date. And it led to The Ultimate Frozen Dessert Book. And then one of my favorites, A La Mode, where we gave 60 pairings of recipes, 60 cakes, pastries, and 60 ice creams to go with them.
What is the secret to matching? This comes up at a lot of birthday parties, to matching a perfect cake with a perfect ice cream.
Well, there's no such thing as the wrong ice cream. So you could pretty much put any ice cream on any cake, but it's getting those flavors right, like a dark Linzer cookie tart with, you know, tart raspberry flavors with a dark chocolate gelato, you know, or you do a dried fruit pie with a pistachio ice cream. So it's getting those flavor combinations that are just right.
We are talking to Bruce Weinstein on this week's edition of Food Friday. It is a special frozen treat edition to mark the beginning of August. And we want to hear from the ice cream makers out there, or custard makers, or you name it. Do you do it at home? How big a rigmarole is it? Do you have a favorite flavor, a favorite recipe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Bruce Weinstein with us talking about these frozen treats, author of a whole bunch of cookbooks, co-author, I should say, including a few on delicious frozen desserts. May have answers to your questions. If there's something that just doesn't come out right with your home ice cream projects, call in at 800-642-1234. Bruce, I got to admit, for some reason in my head, an ice cream maker is this like arcane Area 51 technology that only pros are supposed to use. I look online. They're not that expensive. They're not that complicated. Can you make the case for taking the plunge and getting some kind of home ice cream maker?
Yeah, and it used to be that getting an ice cream maker that didn't require salt and ice was really high tech. You know, the kind with the built-in compressor, they've gotten so much less expensive and they're so easy to use. And also, if you're the kind of person that always has room in your freezer for something, there are lots of ice cream makers that have a container that you store in the freezer and then you put that in the machine and there's no need to plug it in or do anything else. That frozen container will freeze your ice cream as it churns. And there is nothing like making your own. It is better than anything you could buy at the store. So you should go ahead and buy yourself an ice cream machine, and those containers that you freeze and keep frozen, they make the best wine cooler for champagne and white wine.
Ooh. Now let's talk about some specifics of ice cream making. One recipe from one of your books, strawberry ice cream Philadelphia style. I know about Philadelphia style cream cheese. What's Philadelphia style ice cream? I think we lost Bruce there. Do you hear me, Bruce? Nope, we're breaking up again. We're going to take a little break now. In the meantime, I will invite you to call in at 800-642-1234. If you are an ice cream maker, love to hear the stories of your ice cream making. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can get your call in or your comment in while we reconnect with our guest. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call on this edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's this week's edition of Food Friday with a focus on delicious frozen desserts and the making of ice cream. You could join in if you have some experience making ice cream. Some questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Cookbook co-author Bruce Weinstein is with us. He's made many a frozen treat over the span of his career. Bruce, we lost connection there. We were talking about that strawberry ice cream, Philadelphia style ice cream, strawberry flavor. Tell us a little about that.
Well, Philadelphia style ice cream is the old fashioned, no egg ice. It's not a frozen custard. It's simply your cream, your sugar, and whatever flavoring, in this case, strawberries. It's so easy to make. Yes, you still need an ice cream machine, but it is the freshest, brightest, most purest form of ice cream.
And what other styles of, now straight up ice cream, before we get into the worlds of sorbets and custards and things like that, are there other non-Philadelphia things that we would call ice cream?
Well, sure. Once you add eggs into the mix, you do end up with a frozen custard-based ice cream, which is what most people think of as ice cream when they eat ice cream. Now, that's made with cream, and it's made with some eggs. Now, when you go to Europe and you talk about gelato, their version of ice cream actually has no cream in it. In Italy, gelato is made strictly with whole milk and lots of egg yolks. But the thing is, in Europe, whole milk has a slightly higher fat content than it does in the U.S. So when we make gelato here, the way to get it right, the trick, is to add a little tiny touch of cream to your whole milk to bring the milk fat content up a little bit.
Now, I've done a lot of editions of Food Friday over the years. I don't run into words that are new to me that often, but here is one, semifreddo.
Semifreddo.
Yeah, what is this?
It just means, in Italian, that just means partially frozen. So semifreddo is like the most amazing dessert. It's an ice cream style dessert that you don't need a machine for. Ooh. You can put it into a loaf pan and freeze it, and then you slice it, and it's kind of like a cross between marshmallow and ice cream and meringue, and you could have it plain. You could flavor it with chocolate or nuts or nougat, and it is so simple to make, and you don't need a machine, and it is one of my favorite frozen desserts.
Okay, I'm a little offended that nobody told me about this, because it sounds awesome. What?
It is
and
awesome.
It seems pretty simple to make. Just talk us through the process of what are we combining, and how long do we freeze it, that kind of thing.
There are basically three components to making a semifreddo. Whipped cream, which gets folded in. You need egg yolks beaten with sugar over hot water. Basically, you're making like a zabaione, which is that Italian egg yolk custard dessert. And then you need a meringue, egg whites that are beaten with sugar. So you fold those three components together, the meringue, the beaten egg yolks, and the whipped cream, along with other flavorings, whether you're having a raspberry puree or melted chocolate. You line a loaf pan with plastic wrap. You put that in. You freeze it for at least 6 to 8 hours. And then you slice it, and you have the most amazing frozen dessert ever.
That sounds fantastic. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Alloway. Matt, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest has tried any of the Mexican ice creams from the paleterias that are coming up here in Wisconsin. We've got at least three of them here in Green Bay. And what I like about them is that they have a lot fewer chocolate flavors and a lot more interesting flavors, like you can get tequila ice cream, you can get a mango ice cream or lychee ice cream. What does he think?
Matt, thanks for the call. Mexican ice cream, Bruce.
Well, I've never been to one of those paleterias in Wisconsin. I have been to a few in New York, and you're right. I do find that they often carry a lot of fruit flavors as opposed to the nuts and the chocolates. I do actually find that quite interesting about Mexican ice creams, that they are more fruit flavor based. When I'm going for a paleta, you know, the ice cream on a stick, I actually like the fruit without the cream. I like the frozen juices and the frozen watermelon ice and the mango ice. That's what quenches my parched throat when it's really hot out and I want something fruity.
Matt, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hope you're not like slamming chocolate, Matt, because there are some fans here. We are talking about frozen desserts on Food Friday. Bruce Weinstein is with us. He's written many cookbooks, including a few on the topic of frozen desserts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of ice cream or sorbet or, hey, we're in Wisconsin, custard? Do you make your own of any of those? Call in and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. So Bruce, talking about these fruit flavors makes me think of sorbets. What goes into making a sorbet?
Well, at its core, simplest place, a sorbet is just fruit and some sort of sugar. For instance, like a raspberry sorbet, you would puree raspberries, and then you would add in sugar, maybe a little corn syrup, which I know sounds, ooh, corn syrup, why are you adding that? Well, it gives it a certain texture that's really good. Sometimes a little extra water is added with the sugar to make a sugar syrup. So it's going to be sweetened fruit. Again, you're going to have to put that into an ice cream machine to get the creamy texture you're looking for in a sorbet. If you just put it into a container that you freeze and scrape it off the top, then you end up with a very coarse icy dessert, which is much closer to what would be known as a granita or grains. And that's how you can make the difference between a granita and a sorbet, is mostly that one is put into an ice cream machine and it gets smooth as air is mixed into it while it's frozen, and the other is frozen hard and scraped up.
Now, you've written a lot about frozen desserts, as I mentioned. Are there common, you know, mistakes or problems people run into when making ice cream, et cetera, in their ice cream makers?
Well, one of the things that people complain about is that sometimes their machines don't really freeze. It just never takes too long. Or if they have the kind of machine they keep in the freezer, by the time it's cool, you know, by the time it's warmed up and lost its freeze and lost its mojo, the ice cream hasn't firmed up. You must chill your ice cream mixture down. It must be refrigerator cold before it goes into any style of ice cream machine. It'll keep the machine from having to overwork. It'll freeze faster. And also, the faster it freezes, the less air gets churned into it while it's freezing. And that's the difference between premium ice cream and less than premium ice cream. When you buy a super premium ice cream in the supermarket, it's dense, it's chewy. I mean, even go back to the original when Häagen-Dazs first came out. It had such a different texture than you know, the store brand ice cream that came in those, you know, rectangular cartons. If you let that thaw in the sink, you'll end up with a container full of foam because there's so much air mixed into it. So you, as quickly as possible, to get as little air mixed in as you can.
All right, now here's another category I'm not familiar with, a British pudding. This is a frozen thing. And when I think of pudding in England, I think of like Yorkshire pudding, which is a whole different thing. That's not even in our conversation here. What do we mean by a British pudding in this context?
Well, a summer pudding is actually not frozen, but what I do is I serve that with ice cream. And so in my book, A La Mode, there's a recipe for summer pudding. And summer pudding is a fabulous summertime dessert. It's layered like in a baking dish or a souffle dish of literally slices of white bread with a mixture of fresh berries that are cooked with sugar, so like you're making a jam. And you layer the bread and the jam mixture, and you let that chill overnight, and then you unmold that. So you have this beautiful sort of toast, untoasted bread jam cake. And I love to serve either a semifreddo on top of that, and we just talked about what that is, or I just do the simplest vanilla ice cream. And that is a dessert worthy of any summer.
Talking to Bruce Weinstein, cookbook author. We're looking at frozen desserts, making our own ice creams and custards and sorbets and you name it. And you can name it. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you make ice cream at home? Are you making some right now or maybe plans this weekend? Do you have favorite kinds of ice cream to eat, no matter who makes it? A favorite flavor, a favorite style? And do you have questions for our guests to help up your home ice cream game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bruce, you just mentioned vanilla ice cream. And I know some connoisseurs, if they want to compare one ice cream maker to another, they'll stack up vanilla versus vanilla to see who does it best. What is the key to a great vanilla ice cream?
The key to a great vanilla ice cream is going to be the quality of your vanilla. And vanilla runs the range from artificial vanilla flavors, which some can be pretty good, to pure vanilla, double strength vanilla, triple strength vanilla. The purity and the quality of your vanilla will dictate everything in your vanilla ice cream. And I have to say, I discovered something new in this last week. Where I live in rural New England, there is a little wonderful creamery that makes ice cream. And I stopped last week to get some for company that was coming for dinner. And they had a flavor I hadn't seen before. And they just called it sweet cream. And basically, he said it's their vanilla base without the vanilla. And it was truly amazing. It just tasted of dairy. It was just sweet. And the sweetness came also just from the cream, which was farm fresh. So you want to go for purity of ice cream.
Wow.
Try a vanilla ice cream without the vanilla.
I think we might be able to find some fresh cream here in Wisconsin to try that with.
I think you can.
Just a hunch. That sounds great. Now, people get, I won't say weird, but experimental with flavors. Like one of my colleagues here was on the show talking about, we did a show on garlic, and she talked about making garlic ice cream, which I know. But you got it. This actually sounds pretty good. You've done a sweet potato ice cream, which I could see working pretty well. What do you think?
Yeah, sweet potatoes are wonderful because they're creamy and they're smooth. They're used a lot in Asian desserts. And, you know, here in the U.S., we usually think of sweet potato pie, and that's sort of the end of it. But in Asia, they use yellow sweet potatoes, orange sweet potatoes, purple sweet potatoes. They put them in custards and puddings. They put them in baked things. So I decided I was just going to put sweet cooked sweet potato into an ice cream base, and it made it richer, and it gave it a depth of flavor, and it almost had hints of caramel. It was absolutely an amazing addition.
Now, have you tried any flavoring of ice creams that, you know, you regretted? Like, yeah, maybe there is something, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should.
Well, I'm a big believer in that. If you like something, you should do it. So it's there. Really, nothing is off bounds. But you mentioned garlic ice cream. I have to say, I'm not a huge fan. It tastes a little like, you know, a frozen sauce that should be on a chicken breast, for my taste. In testing recipes for that first ice cream book, I had to go through quite a few tries to get my lavender ice cream right, because it just, you know, the tiniest bit was all it needed. And of course, you start with a lot, just like as if I'm making chocolate or coffee. And I had to keep coming back because it was just a little too bathroom deodorizer for me. But in the end, came out with it just right.
Now, I peeked around online at ice cream makers before the show, and now I'm sure I'll see ads for them for years to come. But you could spend, you know, $37, or you could spend over $500. If somebody's out there thinking, I want to get an ice cream maker, how do you assess whether to go all in like that or start cheaper or what?
You know, you have to go by first what are you comfortable affording. If spending $500 on a machine, you know, is something you could do without thinking about it, well, then by all means do it. If you like gadgets, if you like playing with new machines, then go for that. If you're someone who doesn't like electronics and doesn't like gadgets, or if you're someone who doesn't like to cook a lot and you think, well, maybe you'll make ice cream once or twice, go for the cheaper machine. If you're someone who loves ice cream, you love to cook, you know this is something you're going to be doing, then spend a little more.
I should ask about, again, given this is Wisconsin, making our own custard. You mentioned the addition of eggs to that basic ice cream recipe technically turns it into custard. Does the addition of eggs change the process much at all?
Well, you still, when you make Philadelphia ice cream, you heat the cream up, because by heating the cream with the sugar, you get a better texture once it's cooled down and chilled. The only thing you have to do when you're adding eggs is you want to make sure that you cook it to a safe temperature point, which is going to be 140 degrees, and it has to stay there for a few minutes to make sure that the eggs are safe. Otherwise, a lot of people can't eat raw eggs or shouldn't eat raw eggs if they have immune issues. So you just want to make sure your eggs are completely cooked through, and all of my recipes tell you how to do that. So if you follow my recipes, they are safe to eat. The eggs will all be cooked through.
Excellent. Now, our producer, Colleen Leahy, says some of the best ice cream she ever had was in Door County here in Wisconsin. It was a goat's milk ice cream. Mm. Have you worked with non-cow milk in ice cream?
I have. It's funny you should mention that, because I did write a book a few years ago called Goat Meat Milk Cheese, and it was the first ever all-goat cookbook.
Wow.
And although we didn't make goat ice cream for that book, we have a whole chapter in that book on cooking with goat milk. And so making ice creams with alternative milks is easy. It's easy to substitute for. You can make, you know, vegan ice creams with nut milks. I do that all the time. I use oat milk. I use almond milk, coconut milk. So goat milk is just a perfect extension of what you can do with ice cream.
And when we're using things other than cow milk, like, do you have to adjust the other ingredients to calibrate in any way? I guess I'm thinking especially of the, you know, the non-dairy milks, the vegan milks.
If you're using the non-dairy milks, you want to make sure that you're looking for unsweetened and unflavored varieties, because you can get, you know, containers of almond milk and oat milk that are vanilla and they're pretty sweet, and that will affect your recipe because you're already adding flavors and sugar to your recipe. So if you're going to substitute non-dairy milks, make sure you're looking for it unsweetened and plain.
That sounds pretty good. Okay. Are there any, like, experiments out there you'd recommend people with ice cream makers try? Stuff that might not be on people's radar.
Well, you know, you can always here's something I absolutely love. If you're like me, you have at least once in your life left the ice cream out, for you forgot to put it back, and it's completely melted. Or you got stuck in traffic, and by the time you got home, the ice cream you bought at the store was liquid. You know what? If you have an ice cream machine, pour that liquid back into your ice cream machine and turn it on. Turn it back into ice cream.
Time for one more caller. Anne is with us in Amory. Anne, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm quite interested in this book. I've not made ice cream, but my husband's a fan of the ice cream. I would think it'd be fun to try my own.
All right.
So I needed to start with, I read the book first.
Okay, and thanks for the call. Bruce, what I know some of your frozen dessert books are out of print. Is there a title Anne can look
the
for,
ultimate,
though?
Yes, the Ultimate Ice Cream Book is in print. It is available. It is the first and the best ice cream book that I've written. And it, you know, there's a reason that, you know, we were on QVC with that book when it first came out in 99. And there's a reason that book has sold over 300,000 copies. It is a great ice cream cookbook.
And thanks a lot for the call. The Ultimate Ice Cream Book. You can look for that. Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Bruce Weinstein, frozen dessert lover, ice cream maker, author of The Ultimate Ice Cream Book, among many other books he's co-authored, along with Mark Scarborough. We talked about making our own ice cream and ice cream comparable items on this week's edition of Food Friday. If you have a favorite, maybe a favorite recipe or a favorite one to eat, you can share it with us email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you are planning to vote in person on Tuesday in Wisconsin's primary elections, find out what you need to know. An election clerk joins the show with advice and answers to your questions. That's Monday morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Also, we'll be previewing and then post-viewing Tuesday's elections, both on The Morning Show and here on Central Time. That's Monday and Wednesday coming up here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we asked you to call in and share your favorite video games and computer games, past and present. And you did. Lots of great recommendations, and you shared some more on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kimberly writes, "When I was a teenager, I loved playing the PC game Roller Coaster Tycoon with my younger sister. We would build amusement parks, choose how much each ride was and how much to get in. If rides broke down, you'd have to get them fixed. If people got sick on a ride, you'd have to get it cleaned up." And Kimberly says, "When I visit my friend, I love to play Super Mario Kart and Nintendo 64. Good memories. Haven't played any new games since then, but on occasion," Kimberly says, "I'll plug in that classic Super Mario Kart and play that." Brandy recommends Mario 3. And Jacqueline says, "Galaga." Now, one of the old arcade ones. I like Galaga. I'm not that good at it, but I had a long run over the years of I'd go into a bar. Oh, they've got Galaga. Put in my quarter, start playing it, and the fire button would not work. So I would dodge aliens as long as I could until they crashed into me. Made it a lot less fun. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.